Ted Nurse, Dexter Gordon, and Johnny Griffin lead on Blues Up and Down, with George Gables on piano, Rufus Reed on bass, Eddie Gladden on drums. This was a memorable live performance at New York's Carnegie Hall in 1976. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And, of course, as we edge closer and closer to the end of the year, we do have to put a finishing touch on one of the stories that we've been following for about 2 years now, and that is the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation. The year seems to be ending badly for them and their fraudulent charity empire. And it seems as if worse is yet to come in 2018. When Lead Stories reported earlier this month on a trove of thousands of files the FBI released from its electronic vault on its ongoing probe of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, which we just simplify and call the Clinton Foundation, we predicted that there should be much more coming based on the labyrinthine nature of the foundation and its related operations. Charles Ortel, a retired Wall Street banker turned financial investigator, has been probing the innards of the foundation for 2 years as an expert in charity fraud. He declared early on that the evidence he uncovered suggested the foundation was the, quote, largest unprosecuted fraud, charity fraud, in the United States and in U.S. history. So we're finishing off the year with new information he has uncovered that adds even more fuel to the prosecutorial fire engulfing the Clintons, their foundation, and a coterie of key players in this foundation scheme. Thanks, Charles, for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Eutrice, to be back on your air.
Great to have you. Well, I see you've been busy still. You haven't let up as we come to the end of the year. What tidings of great, well, it's not joy, but what tidings do you bring about the Clintons as we round out the year?
Well, I think that the Clintons have been involved, possibly with members of the Obama administration, in a longstanding attempt to cover up this fraud, this charity fraud. And I think when you go back into the history, it's going to, assuming history is told fully, this will prove the adage that if you want to hide an elephant, the best way to hide an elephant is in plain sight. This thing started out as a fraud, in my opinion, back in 1997, in October 23rd, 1997. It was a relatively small fraud at first, but it grew and it grew and it grew. And I think when we really pull on this, we will be able to prove, and I say we, when the FBI, the reinvigorated FBI, the Department of Justice, and other government authorities really pull on this, they will be able to see that the Clintons most likely duped the Obamas in 2007 and 8, while the Obamas may have had some opposition research done on the Clintons. I'm sure they did. They probably didn't know to look as deeply into what was going or what was happening, what was happening with the Clinton Foundation in 2007 and 8 as Hillary fought a vain effort to become the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party. They just didn't have the wherewithal initially to get into the weeds. And then, you know, my contention is I think we're going to discover that sometime in June 2008, the Obamas and the Clintons smoked a peace pipe. But and the Clintons agreed to support the Obamas with their contacts, with their resources, their financial and other resources. But I don't think they told the Obamas the whole truth. By Obamas, I mean Team Obama. the whole truth about the status of the Clinton Foundation, because at that moment in June 2008, they still hadn't put together their filings for the calendar year 2007 for any foundation entity. So all the while through the general election, then through the process where the incumbent Obama administration decided to put Hillary in as Secretary of State, I think the Obamas did not have the upper hand in any negotiation. I think the Clintons knew what was wrong with the Clinton Foundation, but they purposefully hid that from the Obamas. So now we discover, you ask what's new. I guess I hadn't really focused upon the fact that all the while that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and indeed until September 30th, 2013, there was no Inspector General sitting on top of the Secretary, the Department of State, for that whole period. That means there was nobody to really raise a howl of protest over, you know, wait a minute, no previous Secretary of State in the email age conducted 100% of government business over a personal unsecured server. There was nobody to complain about that. And this new fellow, Steve A. Linick, L-I-N-I-C-K, he was put in there on the 30th of September 2013. So there was no empowered, independent Inspector General sitting on top of this mess. There was nobody other than Lois Lerner for the bulk of this period sitting on top in the IRS of the charity department that would have smelled out, sussed out this fraud. That looks very suspicious to me. And then, you know, you start going back over the timeline. Steve Linick apparently, or the powers that be, waited until early 2014 to try to retrieve these emails. And they didn't do it, it would seem, in the direct manner that I would have taken. On the second I found out about the theft of government property, I would have raised a hue and a cry immediately. Like, you know, where are all the emails from this period here? I mean, come on, guys. Every other Secretary of State had emails. Why aren't there any Hillary Clinton emails? And how come, I think it was Tom Fitton's group at Judicial Watch was asking, making Freedom of Information Act requests. Trey Gowdy was beginning to make requests. Others were making requests. And how come it took until the 4th of December 2014 for our government to get a portion of these emails back? You know, and where's all the correspondence file? Did Linick pound the table? If so, who did he complain to? What was the response? Who were the people who may have conspired to delay the release of these emails until after the pivotal 2014 midterm election? And then what happened? And it's amazing that Hillary actually chose to title her book What Happened, because, you know, there's so many questions what happened around her whole time as Secretary of State and then afterwards. But what was really going on from December 4th, 2014? How long did it take members of our government, the different branches, to realize, my God, there's classified information on these emails that were held on private servers? And so, you know, why then did this Sally Yates get a recess appointment on the 10th of January 2015 as Deputy Attorney General? That's the person who runs the Justice Department. You know, why was she slotted in there? How much was she told about the potential vulnerability that the Clinton camp had politically at that moment in time, as Hillary began to contemplate her eventual run to be first the Democratic nominee and then President of the United States? Sally Yates begins operating the Justice Department as Deputy AG. Then Hillary announces that she's running for president on the 12th of April, 2015. Then Loretta Lynch is sworn in as Attorney General on the 27th of April, 2015. Then Sally Yates is confirmed by the Senate on the 13th of May, 2015. Then you have the official launch on the 13th of June, 2015. And then by the 6th of July, 2015, and that's the treasure trove you were talking about, Utrice. In fact, you know, all the many times, all the thousands or millions of times that different people uttered the falsehood that, you know, the investigation, there was no investigation into these emails. It was just a normal national security review It was not a formal investigation. Well, it turns out that's a bold-faced lie, that by the 6th of July, 2015, the Inspector General for the DNI, that's the Department of National Intelligence, I think, you know, the top National Intelligence Bureau, had issued a referral to the FBI under a statute, Section 811C, concerning mishandling of classified information by Hillary Clinton and likely by Uma Abedin and others. And it took 4 days after that for James Comey, on the 10th of July, 2015, his FBI, to open a full-scale criminal investigation into felony crimes of mishandling classified information. Well, I mean, I'm just amazed. If these facts that are in the FBI vault file are all true, and this timeline is all true, I am amazed that the Democratic Party would have allowed the Clintons to continue this ridiculous idea of running her as the candidate. I'm even more amazed that Bernie Sanders would be allowed to say that, you know, he didn't care about those damn emails. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, it's last time I checked, being investigated, full-scale criminal investigation by the FBI on federal felony counts, where each count is 10 years in prison, seems to me to be a pretty serious matter. And that's just the email side of it. I don't understand why our IRS, or I suppose maybe I do understand why our IRS was asleep at the switch on the other side of the coin. And that's where, you know, Donald Trump refers to the leader of North Korea as Rocket Man. And I'm starting to refer to Bill Clinton as Racket Man. So, here you have Crooked Hillary, you know, mishandling classified information at the same time that Racket Man is out there pretending he's operating a charity, when in reality he's flitting around the world doing who knows what where, and how much of that money that he is sent towards his various supposed charities actually ends up in the books and records of each of the charities. So I'm just amazed at the risk profile that A, the Clintons would have, their backers would have, and B, the Democratic Party would have. And then you think about the number of people who must have known about this in the FBI and the IRS and the Department of Justice, and that instead of deciding to, you know, maybe we ought to run a better candidate, you know, the real collusion story here, I think, lies in the Democratic Party operatives in the quote establishment deciding to run a brutally flawed candidate. And was that possibly because, you know, getting such a candidate in power would have then given the operatives the ability to hold enormous leverage over the President of the United States in Hillary Clinton? And this is a big, big story in my mind. And that's just the, you know, the email and the Clinton Foundation pieces of it.
Well, let's go back to your earlier statement in which you said that you are surmising that Barack Obama was duped. How is it that you surmise that as opposed to he was a full-fledged part of this?
See, I think what happened was that in the if we go back to that time frame, which I remember very well, just because that was when I got my start back into media on September 16th, 2008. I was then beginning the process of exposing GE. And at that moment in time, I'm sure you remember better than I do, Utrice, the markets were in turmoil. It's very expensive to run a campaign. And the last thing most rich people want to do as they're losing, you know, on paper, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in their core activities, their stocks, their bonds, et cetera, the last thing they want to do is turn around and write a check. So as a guess, the way this worked, and I'm just guessing now, is that Barack Obama and the Democrats needed cash. The Clintons, because they had this, you know, this money pipeline, principally from Unitaid, the non-governmental organization based in Switzerland, that was sending literally hundreds of millions of dollars towards the Clintons and unregulated charities. Barack Obama and Democrats needed cash. The Clintons had the cash via their charity. And during the heat of the campaign, all they cared about was getting Barack Obama across the line. which I think was more or less a foregone conclusion given the weak, the pitiful state of John McCain's campaign and you know, message, frankly. Even I didn't vote for John McCain. So, you know, what they needed in that short period was cash, and the Clintons had the cash, the so-called Clinton cash, from, as Peter Schweitzer likes to call it. And then, you know, in the victory, having won the election, but not having been sworn in, Barack Obama was in no position to expose the Clintons. If he exposed the Clintons, would he have been sworn in? Once he took, especially once they all got behind Hillary Clinton, rushing Hillary across the line to be Secretary of State, even as the Clinton Foundation books were a diabolical state of fraud, you know, having pushed her across the line, pushed her through the Senate, having gotten her sworn in, he couldn't turn around and say, well, my first act, I think I'll undo that and investigate the Clintons. I think they likely, you know, became willing might be too strong a word, but they became stuck in a place where they couldn't expose the fraud. They had to play along. And the Clintons, looking a few steps ahead, said, well, all right, we got them now. You know, they're never going to expose us. And, you know, they then decided to take it to galactic level and run her as to be president of the United States. And thank goodness she was not elected.
So the investigation began, according to the papers released, the documents released. There was a full-fledged investigation, and it was pretty broad in scope. In the meantime, the person handling the investigation under the auspices, too, of the Justice Department, how do you account based on, I mean, just putting things into place here, how do you account for the fact that a Justice Department under Donald Trump also seemed reluctant to, at first, to look into the matter of the Clinton Foundation and its operations?
That's a very good question, Eutrice. You know how to ask good questions, which is why I like coming on your show.
I do about two good questions a year. That was the second one.
No. So what happened, actually, it turns out, is that after the 10th of, on or after the 10th of July 2015, a grand jury was convened in the Eastern District of Virginia. And looking back into the history today, I realized that the U.S. attorney acting at that time was a man called Dana, D-A-N-E, then B-O-E-N-T-E. And if we go into the FBI vault files, what we see are evidence of many, many subpoenas issued. Some are issued under seal out of that Eastern District in connection with a grand jury investigation that was, it seems, supervised by this person. Now, this person then, when Sally Yates, remember we talked about her first, when Sally Yates was fired by Trump, guess who replaced her? Dana Buente. And when Jeff Sessions replaced him, guess who became the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America? Dana Buente, from 9 February 2017 to 25 April 2017. So it sure looks to me, when I look through the list of people that are now in the press, you know, the McCabes, the Strokes, the, you know, all these names, it's a close circle of people at the FBI, a close circle of people at Department of Justice. And many of these people, when you look deeply into their resumes, when you look at, let's say, Comey and Rosenstein, you find out that they worked together, in theory, investigating the Clintons, but in practice, finding nothing meaningful in connection with Whitewater. That's very suspicious to me. You then see, in the period 2001 to 2005, in the case of Comey and Mueller, you see those two involved investigating the Clinton Foundation and finding nothing. Then you see from 2000, I think, six or so until he was confirmed as Deputy Attorney General, you see in Rod Rosenstein, a person now Deputy Attorney General of the Justice Department, somebody who could not see what it seems to me obvious fraud involving Laureate, which was then in a theoretical joint venture with the Clinton Global Initiative, which didn't exist. You see obvious fraud that you know, a larger fraud than Ron Boxey was tagged for, and again, Rod Rosenstein was supposedly looking into that, but didn't catch the full extent of it, the full flavor, the full contours of it. And then you see also the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, highly suspicious money declared as going from an office in New York to an office in Baltimore that didn't exist. And again, the man on that case is the, you know, the ineffable Rod Rosenstein. There's a limited number of people here, all of whom seem to be tied into the transactions that surely, to me, appear to be, as we talked at the beginning, the largest unprosecuted fraud in history. And yet this is the team that's in the seats that's supposed to get to the bottom of all this. And, you know, this just reeks to me. And in the case of Donald Trump, yet the simple answer to the question is, you know, between the time he won on the 8th of November and the time he was inaugurated on the 20th of January, 2017, I mean, we remember the turmoil, the hue and cry, the resistance, the recount, all the efforts to sort of throw problems against him. And then I don't think it's fair to say he ever had a honeymoon. It was an immediate nightmare for him. You know, the people, the diehard members of the resistance, they just obstructed him every step of the way. And I think it's really only been in the recent weeks now that he got the significant piece of legislation signed into law, with it taking effect January 1st next year. It's only with that victory that I think he's been able to consolidate his hold. And, you know, begin to take full control of the IRS, the Department of Justice, the FBI, I mean, at least to get it back towards a more balanced and less partisan, less divided environment. He's only now beginning to do that. And I think he's making some moves that are really should terrify those who have been obstructing justice, those who have been breaking the law. They should be absolutely terrified.
But then we have the interesting anomaly, too, that Bob Mueller himself is not without impediments to his investigation. And what happens when the interests of the independent investigation, the special prosecutor, and Bob Mueller's investigations, which may coincide, what happens when you have a compromised investigation because of Bob Mueller brings a lot of baggage and a lot of contradictions? And how does that not taint the probe into the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I think so far in the Mueller investigation, and several months ago, a top investigative journalist I know who's resident in you know him, Richard Pollack, resident in Washington, D.C., he was explaining to me that sort of mid-year this year, Mueller had more senior-level appointees working on his team than Trump had managed to get confirmed into the Justice Department. So, you know, Mueller's really, you know, gone at this very hard, and what does he have to show for it so far? I mean, things could change, but so far he's got a plea agreement with Michael Flynn, who I would argue is not the strongest anti-Trump witness or anti-anybody witness, unfortunately. And you've got indictments, which an indictment against Manafort, which I think is, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but it sure seems to be far off the question of whether there was Russian collusion in the 2015-16 timeframe. So he doesn't have much to show for it yet. Mueller doesn't. And I would argue that Mueller should never have been allowed. He should never have taken the role, that he was so conflicted given his prior failures, frankly, multiple failures investigating Clinton projects that certainly seems suspicious to me, and whose true evolution will be, I think, teased out in coming months. So Mueller is, you're absolutely right. I think Mueller's whole team is flawed. Some of his team is deeply flawed. His top guy, Weissman, I think has a very checkered record when it comes to thinking about his role in the Enron task force. So I think that's not good at all. On the other hand, I think we're beginning to now see, and I think people who've been stuck into this trying to get to the bottom are beginning to have more visibility into the true scandal. The Clintons are very good at misdirection and getting you to focus on a piece, small piece of the puzzle while ignoring the elephant. The elephant is that the Clinton business model, which should not be the Democrat business model, is a two-pronged strategy. You lie under oath and you obstruct justice. And you get people around you who are prepared to do that, and you can get away with what they've gotten away with in their political careers. That is, you know, there are plenty of people of, you know, questionable background in the Republican Party as well. But I really don't, you know, I kind of like the two-party system. I think it's good to have two organizations going head-to-head against each other and going through the important issues of the day and teasing the pluses and minuses out, and then hopefully coming up with solutions that on balance are better for the American people than any single party could do. I like that in concept, but I sure hate to see one great party, frankly, the Democrat Party, blow itself up, staying wedded to inveterate, in my mind, criminals. I mean, I'll say it flat out. I mean, Donald Trump, when he calls, he's now calling Hillary just crooked. He's leaving out the Hillary part, just calling her crooked. And I wish he'd call her husband in name only, Bill Clinton, racket man, because that's what he is. He's just a racket man. I mean, there's everything he comes up with, it sounds smooth. He knows how to weave those words together. But you can never actually catch him in any sort of causal link between what he says he did himself and what actually happened.
It depends on what is, you see.
Right. I mean, we fell for that. You know, I mean, I guess I understand people who can stay married to a, you know, outright philanderer forever. You just get to a point where it's too embarrassing to admit the mistake.
Well, actually, they're not exactly in a state of wedded bliss at the moment and haven't been for quite some time, according to reports. So, okay, what are they leading up to? You have had the opportunity to do your own financial investigation of the Clinton Foundation and its various affiliated entities. If you were to project yourself into this world of criminal investigation with an eye toward prosecution, what would you say is the weakest spot right now for the Clintons and the foundation? Where are they most exposed?
Well, it's a long list, but I would start with the fact that there's been an abrupt change in their public perceptions. You know, I think that we talked in the past about this book, Joe Connison's book, Man of the World. I noticed it was in my favorite bookstore the other day at Strand, down on 12th Street and Broadway there. And I noticed that Joe Connison's book has a new paperback edition out with a new afterword that goes back over ground. The hardback came out in October 2016. And so now this paperback talks about what, in theory, what really happened and their views of Bill Clinton's view, actually, of what factors are responsible for Hillary's loss. And one that he does cite, or that Connison mentions, is this foundation. And they even try in this book that recently came out to try to argue that the attacks that were launched against the Clinton Foundation were funded by millions of dollars from an alt-right conspiracy. They were unfounded attacks. I mean, it's just, they don't give up. But I think the first problem they have is that in the sea of public opinion, 78-year-old plus hack politicians who failed twice to win elections, starting, you know, in the beginning with all the advantages, don't stand among the likely front runners in 2020. That's the first problem they have. The second problem they have is that you see in President Trump, like him or dislike him, you certainly see a disruptor who will buck conventional wisdom, who has gotten this tax deal across the line. And this tax deal, we can talk about it at another time, but my opinion is, as somebody who follows financial matters, this tax bill is going to put a lot of good dollars in a lot of people's pockets. It's going to be very, very good on balance for the economy. But in the short run, it's going to create a situation where our federal government needs more money. what better place to get it than from foundations like the Gates Foundation and the endowed universities like Harvard, Yale, and Columbia and others that have most unwisely and for who knows what reason so far put their names, their good names, in support of these Clinton Foundation frauds. And they stand under the existing law in a position where they could actually be, they could be shut down. So Trump and his IRS and Justice Department have a lot of leverage against the donors. Now, meanwhile, the trustees of the Clinton Foundation or directors, whichever you want to call them, they stand, in my opinion, significantly exposed for their 20-year track records, in certain cases, of reckless disregard for their duties of care, loyalty, and obedience under state, federal, and foreign law. They've got some serious issues. So when you put all that together, in addition, the Clintons, in theory, have assets. Put all that together. You've got an array of criminal exposures, an array of, I think, civil exposures that are massive here. And next week, we've talked about her before, next week, Corinne Brown will report to federal prison over an $800,000, 20-year roughly, charity slush fund operated in the supposed name of educating children, but in practice being used to fund lifestyles. This is $800,000. This is somebody who was indicted in the summer of 2016 during her election attempt. The FBI and the Department of Justice decided to go ahead with that, but basically to sit on any potential inquiries having to do either with the server or with the foundation or other matters. They sit on that for the Clintons, but they go after this African-American congressman who's running for office. They subsequently win a conviction. They throw the book at her in a 50-page sentencing memo, and the federal judge who's presiding over the trial in the sentencing sentences her to 5 years in federal prison. This is somebody who's, not going to do so well starting at age 71 in a federal prison. I don't care, how nice it may end up being. That's a stunning smackdown for this person. And you're going to let the Clintons, who have been operating, by my calculation, just on their declared books, over $2 billion of a slush fund, and considering the other contours, you're talking the hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars, when you think about all of the affiliates of this mess operated by the Clintons, both Clintons and the daughter. You're going to let them off, but put this African-American congressman in prison for 5 years at age 71? And I think that fact will not be lost on the man who has the big megaphone now, Mr. Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, who certainly likes to make his viewpoints known. It's an easy thing to contrast. You let the Clintons skate, and you put this poor lady in prison for 5 years. Now, I don't know as much about her, Beatrice, as you know. I mean, she may deserve 5 years in prison or more, but it just doesn't seem fair to me that you would let the Clintons off and then put this person in prison for 5 years. It just doesn't seem right to me. I think the Clintons deserve a far worse punishment.
Well, you have, through your research, you have established a kind of organizational chart to the best of your ability. Do you suspect that the investigation now, as it stands, is also looking abroad about the involvement of the Clinton Foundation in other countries soliciting donations, hundreds of millions of dollars, the pay for play that extends into the Middle East and Africa, and many other projects that were reported as doing such good work, but in fact did nothing. I'm referring now, when you marry the Clinton Foundation with, let's say, Bill Clinton's initiative in Haiti, where $10 billion still has not been accounted for. Do you expect that they will be treading into foreign waters as well to make a connection to show the larceny of the foundation, the extent of it?
Well, I do. I mean, I think, I mean, we know, we've talked about it before, we know that the French government branch of the French government called the CORS, as in Sam, then DE, and then Comte, COMPTES, Cour de Comte, is it's a sort of an accounting court, did indeed launch an investigation beginning December 2009 into the master slush fund in Geneva, Unitaid, which in the early years of its time, from 2006 to 2009, sent half of the money, many hundreds of millions that they sent. They sent $300 million towards a branch of the Clinton Foundation that I would argue was never legally formed or operated. So there was a French investigation. It completed. There was one report in towards the end of 2010, and then reports before the equivalent of their House and Senate in 2011. And these reports are in French, hundreds of pages in total, and available to the public. So governments did investigate the initial contours of the fraud, but they didn't go as far as they should have. Now, that's another whole set of questions. I suspect the reason they didn't is that the Obama administration was working with the French to try to move projects along in Libya that didn't turn out so well and in Syria that didn't turn out so well. And, you know, any investigation into this charity matter was just likely shunted aside. So there is a history of at least the French government looking into this and not catching it. But with all the publicity and the mounting publicity, I think the governments around the world are waiting to see what Donald Trump's Justice Department and his IRS are now going to do. And I believe that, you know, most governments, most people around the world need money. And here's a chance for a large number of governments, be they, you know, Australia or France or Norway, or the United Kingdom or Sweden, you name it, I can go on and on and on. The major donors to this fraud have, I think, an obligation in their home countries to try to get the money back. And they have an opportunity in the way U.S. law works to go against some of the large private foundations inside this country, the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Alpha Wood Foundation, the many others are listed out in the Clinton Foundation donor list. These governments can go against the trustees of these private foundations and say, listen, you know, we put money into these Clinton initiatives because we saw your names attached, and we know you Rockefeller people are pretty well-heeled and have, you know, deep staffs. You at the Gates Foundation, you have the ability to suss this out. You put a lot of money in, so we decided to make our donations relying in part on your diligence, and you failed us. And, you know, while we may not necessarily have the strongest case to get our money back, if you ever want to try to do business in our country, you may want to consider reaching an accommodation with us. I see that kind of a process in the new year moving very quickly along. I mean, the Clintons right now, they they just won't learn. I mean, they have an appeal that you can see even as we speak, if you click on it now, where Bill Clinton is offering to double your contribution to the Clinton Foundation. And I guess tomorrow's the last business day of the year in 2017 where you can actually make such a contribution. And pretty soon, accountants, if they can find an accounting firm that would do any work for them, accountants for the Clinton Foundation are going to have to begin work producing a real audit, which even to this day has never been done. So, I mean, they're in big trouble. There's a phrase that should scare any potential donor, which is called tax uncertainties. Whether if you make a donation to a supposed charity, you want to make sure, if it's a large donation, that your lawyers look at the charity with an account and tell you whether there are any tax uncertainties. That means, you know, whether the IRS could look at your charity and say, uh-uh, that's not a charity. Because the last thing you want to do is make a donation to something you think is a charity, write it off on your tax returns, and then discover somebody, the IRS, saying, uh-uh, that wasn't a charity. Then you may have, you know, if it's a foundation doing that, you have legal exposure there. If it's a person doing it, you have legal exposure there. You have financial penalties, reputational risks. And, you know, that's, I think, the place the Clintons are in right now. And I believe... No, actually, I can say this, that a prominent Democrat took me aside, and I met with this person, and they said, Charles, listen, would you stop already? You know, we already understand this thing is a mess. You don't need to, you And I said, look, you may understand it, but I don't see any signs of people getting punished. I don't see any signs here that, you know, we're having justice administered even-handedly in this country, and that's very important. You can't, as I keep harping on this Corinne Brown, you cannot put her in prison for 5 years over an $800,000 slush fund and let these Clintons run riot around the world. Because if you do that, all that's going to mean is that, you know, in time, the next set of fraudsters who come along and next year or 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, they're going to look at this precedent. They're going to say, you know, the way justice works in the United States is you run for office. If you win, you're above the law. If you lose, you're beneath the law. It's that simple. I don't think we want to go down that path anymore.
It should be the case that having this investigation going on for as long as it has been so far, that they have assessed that in many, many, many ways, the Clinton Foundation is operating outside or has been operating outside the law. Even procedurally, you know, in terms of filing its taxes and filling out its forms and so forth, it has just, you know, gone roughshod over the law. And that there is reason to believe, I would imagine, having the investigation in their hands for this long, it should be the case that they have formed preliminary opinions based on the evidence that they have that the foundation is running outside of the law. And therefore, even as they continue the investigation, a good thing would be to shut the foundation down until all these matters are cleared up. Why isn't that an option? Why aren't they doing something like that?
Well, because there isn't an honest trustee on the board. I mean, any part of this. I mean, these are all Clinton hacks.
No, I'm not talking about the trustees. I'm talking about the government. You have a massive fraud on your hands. You have enough information that would lead you to believe this is a major problem. This foundation has multiple problems. But in the meantime, they're still continuing to solicit funds. They're still operating, and the members of the board are still not doing what they're supposed to do. This is a renegade operation. And in as much as that has been established, based on the evidence that they've uncovered so far, that the appropriate thing to do is to take severe action, suspend the operations of the Clinton Foundation until it comes into some kind of accord with what they're supposed to do. Or in the meantime, just simply say that we have a preliminary finding that allows us to shut you down until further notice.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, it's your third great question of the year. the process that really should have happened a long time ago is that in the many states, I think in more than 40 out of the 50 states, and then there's DC also and some other local jurisdictions have rules on this, anywhere where you're required to fill out paperwork and in some cases get a license to solicit, any place where you're supposed to do that, they should not be allowed to solicit funds. That's one step. And now the issue with that is that the second one authority says you cannot solicit funds any longer, other authorities should be putting their heads up and saying, now, wait a minute, you know, perhaps in a million light years from now, if Eric Schneiderman, you know, would wake up and decide that he wanted to administer justice, the New York Attorney General, fairly and not be a political hack enthralled to the Clintons, he would look at the facts, which are obvious. The Clintons' forms for 2016 are still not on the New York State website. We have one day left this year. But clearly, justice has failed the people of New York because our attorney general just can't do his job or can't get that group to do their job properly. You know, you would stop them from soliciting in the state But really, the fastest approach would be if the Attorney General of Arkansas, who is the primary, that's the primary state where this Clinton Foundation, you know, many of the entities were formed in Arkansas, would stand up and, you know, back a truck up one day, unannounced, say tomorrow, tonight at say 8 p.m. And you know, go there with a whole bunch of state police and say, you know, we want to see all of your documents right now. And because we suspect that, you know, you're operating far outside the law, we're going to appoint a conservator to get to the bottom of what happened, not this fictitious book that you wrote, Hillary, what really happened. And similar processes might happen in other states. For example, Florida, Pam Bondi, you know, I see her on television all the time. She has enough time to go on television. She ought to get her department in Florida to take a hard look at what really happened with the William J. Clinton Foundation Corporation. Why was that set up in June of 2009 as a Florida, a new Florida foundation? And then why was it held out as being part of the main foundation when in fact it was a new Florida corporation? It's a long track record there in Florida, and there are a bunch of other states that really, you know, there's a fellow named, I believe from memory, Josh Hawley, who is, I think, the Attorney General of Missouri, running to be governor. You know, he has the, there's a guy in Michigan who's also, I think, running to be governor. Both of these people have the ability right now to stop the Clinton Foundation from soliciting and, you know, appointing conservators to find out what's really going on with this thing. Beyond that, you know, we have a new head of the IRS. I forget exactly when that person was took position inside the IRS. And we know because the IRS confirmed to various media that in July of 2016, the Dallas office of the IRS opened an investigation into the Clinton Foundation. Why is it taking this team so long? Is this the same team in the Dallas office of the IRS that was seconded from the Eastern District of Virginia, looking into the mishandling of classified information of Hillary's email starting around the same time? I mean, what is going on with these people? So the real questions are not only the extent of the fraud, Utrice, but the real questions should include how many people and how many regulatory bodies either failed, missed the obvious, or worse, saw the obvious and elected to cover it up and obstruct the administration of justice. How many co-conspirators are there around this country and around the world who decided that the Clinton way was better than the American way? How many of those people still have jobs? How many of them still have pensions? How many of them, you know, think that they're going to retire on the American taxpayer's dime? You know, there's a large opportunity here, I think, thanks to the work you're doing and your listeners are doing, the encouragement that they give, the pressure they're putting on these. There's a big opportunity here to actually open up scrutiny into this mess, this horrid, fetid swamp, and force the people who've been playing in the swamp and profiting from the swamp to own up to their misdeeds and then serve the types of prison terms and have the types of financial settlements that are owed here. You know, drawing on the precedent set here by Corinne Brown, 5 years federal prison, $800,000. You know, how much time should how many people go away for, and how much money in restitution should be paid for these Clinton Foundation frauds?
By extension, how do other presidential foundations look? Are they similarly, you know, exposed? Barack Obama has started his foundation. He has been doing a lot of travel overseas. My suspicion is that it would not be untoward that he is also looking to fund his presidential library, because that's supposed to be upwards of what, hundreds of millions of dollars. How do the other presidential foundations look in terms of compliance with the law?
Well, I would say every other foundation more than pays lip service to every other established foundation that has a library, more than pays lip service to the rules, which are indeed strict, because they understand you know, that a presidential foundation is not like, you know, if Charles Ortel and Yatrice Leed get together and create the Leed Ortel Foundation, you know, even if we somehow, you know, go out in the backwoods and fire off a gun and up bubbles up some oil and suddenly we're billionaires, it's not going to have the same level of attention as a presidential foundation. So most presidential foundations are pretty careful. Now, most of them, that is to say, after they've gotten their buildings up and running and they've got the archives that are, you know, transferred into their buildings, et cetera, they tend to be pretty careful. The best, it pains me to say this, but the best model that I have seen so far is actually Jimmy Carter, who has he's got separate things. He's got a foundation to handle his library and archive. And then he has a separate one, the Carter Center, which is more to do his overseeing of elections and the various projects that he takes on around the world. They're separate, keeps them separate. The Obama Foundation is in its infancy, really. It is just now starting to, we'll find out how much money they raised in 2017, by November, when they have until November 15th, 2018 to tell us it. So, they're just in their infancy. I did notice, and I have been quoted as saying that I don't like what I see so far. I mean, they may actually have to clean this thing up. They may have to start over. They may have to say, you know, well, we tried it a certain way. We decided to change course, and we're going to maybe refile a slightly different approach, maybe follow the Carter thing and have one to hold the papers of his presidency and a second to engage in the kind of advocacy and mentoring that he wants to do around the world. It may be that they have to do it that way. Now, I was contacted without going into names. I have been given assurances that that team really wants to get it right. And, you know, I listen to assurances. I like to hear them. But this is a case of deeds matter. Let's see how they do on the deeds. But certainly, I mean, the Clinton Foundation stands alone as, you know, the only useful thing about it is it will stand in time as an example of how not to run a presidential foundation. And it's really a great test case. You can look at the record and you can say, anything that they did, don't do. That may be its ultimate utility.
Whatever they did, just don't do that. Do something else.
Sort of an anti-Nike. You know, Nike's slogan is just do it. This is just don't do it.
So why don't we have an official accounting of whatever probes are ongoing? Why aren't we getting any interim reports or some kind of an accounting of what they have found so far? Or is that just too much to ask?
Well, I think, I mean, what I'm told by the experts I've consulted is that, you know, in our system of justice, such as it is, you are indeed innocent until proven guilty, generally speaking. And so investigations normally lead to attempts to get indictments before a grand jury. And if those indictments are not sealed, they become a matter of public record when the indictments happen. And then it proceeds to a trial and people duke it out, whatever the standard is. Whether it's preponderance of evidence, I think, in civil, or guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal, you go through a process, and prosecutors are required to win a conviction. And until you do that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty. So I think it's normal, frankly, that we don't actually know what's happening with the investigations. But I would guess that we've never before been in a position like this in the country or in the modern world where people with such high standing, such great resumes, such long experience have gotten embroiled, have engendered, have enabled a criminal enterprise of this gargantuan size. This has never happened before. And as a guess, you know, all the people in the swamp and around the political system are trying to think through the implications of all this. They don't want to consider it. They'd rather not deal with it. But now it seems to be in a place where they're going to have to deal with it. And so as the events move next year, I will guess they're going to move very quickly. In that light, Donald Trump signed an executive order on the 20th of December, just, you know, last week, that was very, very encouraging as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that it's a sweeping executive order targeting not only public corruption, but human trafficking. It called for placing individuals and organizations on what's called the Office of Foreign Assets Control list. It's a very bad list to be on. Fair number of those people have some tie one way or another to the Clintons. So that's been giving people like me and others encouragement that maybe we're now finally close to a place where Donald Trump's Justice Department and others are actually going to find justice here.
Yeah, justice except that he's been categorized, condemning and really undermining the people who are in a position who he has assigned to do these things. He's been critical of Mueller. He's been critical of Sessions. It's not a good thing at all. Well, that music means that we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Charles, and adding yet another chapter to this ongoing investigation. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.